What's the best part of a Dunkin' Run? The coffee? Is it the coffee or the $1 donut or $2 stuffed bagel minis or $3 sausage, egg, and cheese that you can add to it? The answer, of course, is yes. Time for a Dunkin' Run. $3 offer available on sausage, egg, and cheese sandwich only. Excludes specialty donuts and fancies. Offer valid on medium or larger coffee. Price and participation may vary. Limited time offer terms apply.
Hey, I'm Zach, and one day I'm going to make movies, but right now I'm young, dumb, and not nearly as good-looking as my co-hosts. So with the help of...
I'm Matthew.
I'm Rodrigo.
I'm Steven.
I'm going to learn what makes a movie great by watching all the classics I have skipped over. So pop the corn and turn your cell phone to silent, because it's time for a new episode of Zach on Film. And welcome to another episode of Zach on Film. This week, we are traveling back to 1941 San Francisco as we follow Sam Spade as he tries to find his partner's murderer and some mysterious falcon statue as we talk the Maltese Falcon.
Yay, Maltese Falcon.
Ooh.
Now, I will point this out for people who have not listened to our other show that we do, one of our many other shows in the Major Spoilers Podcast Network. We do another show called Major Spoilers, and occasionally we sit down and we will read a prose book. And many years ago, we reviewed Maltese Falcon, the book, the novel, on the Major Spoilers Podcast. Rodrigo, this is one of your favorite books?
It is. It's one of the few books that I've read more than once.
And
which
why?
Is, I don't know. I think it's partially because it's pretty light. You know, it's like intense, and there's a lot of stuff going on, but the wording of it is just really straightforward and good.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a cool story, and Sam Spade is a cool guy who's also pretty flawed. And kind of a jerk.
Yeah.
But still manages to be likable. And you know, I had to read it for school the first time around, and then I was like, oh, this is actually pretty good. I could read this again.
So give us the rundown, Zach, of the story.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to touch on a couple of major points that hopefully you picked out on.
Okay.
And then we'll give you a chance to ask some questions, because I understand you have some questions about
yes.
this book or about the movie.
Yep.
And so on and so forth.
All right. So the Maltese Falcon starts, and we're in a detective agency, and two partners work there, Sam Spade, our main character, and his partner, Miles Archer. And so it comes in, and a woman comes in and is needing of their services. She is needing them to follow a guy for her who she's worried about and possibly dangerous and stuff. And so both of the two detectives are attracted to this lady. And so Miles, he essentially calls dibs and takes the case, and he's out there, and he goes to follow this man, and he's shot dead.
Mm-hmm.
Dead. And so then it goes on from there, and the person he was following ends up murdered.
Right.
And the police start...
Thursby.
Thursby. And they start suspecting Spade.
Right, the police, yeah.
This police start suspecting Spade of the murder of Thursby. And... there's also a plot line with Archer's wife,
right.
And that's part of why the police think that Spade has committed some of these murders, is because Archer's wife and him are supposedly a thing, and she even asks if Spade murdered Archer so
mm-hmm.
they could be together.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's a plot line that's carried out through the story.
So,
and then eventually
you know,
get into a Falcon story.
Sure, and the Falcon story is that all of these people,
right?
Gutman, O'Shaughnessy, Peter Lorre's character, Joel Cairo.
Yeah, Cairo.
Are all after this, and Thursby.
Falcon.
We're all
yeah,
after Thursby. All after this Falcon that's worth millions of dollars, potentially.
Supposedly, yeah.
And how Sam Spade gets intertwined in all of this. But, you know, oh, was
big
that lightning?
Thunder, yeah.
Okay.
Jeez.
We've got a big thunderstorm going on here. You'll probably hear that in a second, Rodrigo.
Yeah, probably.
Yeah, I heard a pop, and so I know the electricity was flying there. but let me ask you, though, and Rodrigo, jump in on this, too, because in the first 15 minutes or 20 minutes of the movie, we meet Sam Spade, who smokes, and that's fine. I mean, he rolls his own cigarettes, so he's tough.
I would just like to say that I understand why smoking seems cool, because
Humphrey Bogart
makes
it look cool.
Yeah, he made it look cool with the whole lighting of the pushing down thing. That was cool.
The little lighter.
Yeah, the lighter that lights a match thing.
So he smokes, he drinks, he has affairs with his partner. He doesn't seem too broken up when Archer is killed. What then makes Sam Spade, I mean, he basically threatens to wring O'Shaughnessy's neck at the end of the movie. What makes Sam Spade then such a wonderful character in this movie? Now, remember the Dashiell Hammett, or was it?
Yeah, Dashiell Hammett.
Yeah, Dashiell Hammett wrote multiple stories. Sam Spade became a regular radio mystery show, you know, other books, other TV shows, et cetera, made off Sam Spade. What, Zach, makes this character so memorable in this movie? Why is he so likable? Or is he likable?
I think he's kind of that, possibly, depending on, this time period, one of the first kind of heroes that you like, but almost feel bad about liking, to a point where he's a hero character, and he is following the law and is trying to do his job, but he's also not the most morally ethical person, I would say. He kind of skirts around stuff and is willing to possibly bend some rules to get what's going on done, and he's not above threatening people, and he bursts with anger. And so I think that character has some draws to it. Like, you see that in now, he'd kind of be like a what's John Hamm's character in Mad Men? Whatever his name is. And
Dan Draper.
Yeah, Don Draper.
Don Draper is where it
is. And Walter White in Breaking Bad. Kind of those characters where you have to, you're conflicted on whether you want to root for the main character or not.
Okay. I'll accept that. Did you know that Sam Spade, though, is based on Dashiell Hammett himself, because he did work as a Pinkerton detective in the 1920s. And then he also based a lot of what Sam Spade was on what his fellow detectives thought themselves to be.
Yeah. I read that a little bit.
I think the reason why we all, and when I say we, I mean us dudes, I think, react.
Oh, hey, the ladies all like a Bogart and Sam Spade, too.
And it's probably a similar issue, is that Sam Spade is kind of the guy that we want to be to a certain degree. You know, he's dangerous, he's rough, and he can do things and get things accomplished on his own. And his mom isn't walking into his room and like, take out the trash. It's like, Mom, I got
birds to find.
I got Pokemans to catch, right? Nobody would tell Sam Spade when and where to catch his Pokemans.
Yeah, that is true.
Yeah. I wouldn't want to.
Why, he'd sock you right in the face.
Humphrey Bogart, I mean, this is a role that made Humphrey Bogart a star.
Right.
Right. This set him up to then go into Casablanca, set him up to go play African Queen, all these other great movies. He was not the first choice to play Sam Spade.
It was
George Raft, who had been in a number of, you know, leading man type positions. But he, George Raft, turned it down because he didn't want to work with this, I don't know, this guy that I've never heard of before, John Huston, according to Raft. John Huston today is revered as one of the great, not only great directors, but actors, writers. And John Huston wrote the screenplay, the adaptation of the book for the big screen. And in this day and age, this is something that I also find very fascinating. In this day and age where audiences complain left and right about, oh, we're remaking the Spider-Man movies, we're remaking the Batman movies, we're remaking this, that, and the other thing. By 1941, this was the third remake of The Maltese Falcon. The first one was done in 1931. But it was basically banned from the movie theaters because it was a little bit too lewd.
Too sexy.
Too sexy. And then the second one was called Satan Met a Lady. That was in 1936. That had Bette Davis in it. So listeners, if you want to go back and find out some of who our big crushes are, celebrity crushes, go back and listen to one of our top five episodes where Bette Davis makes an appearance on that list. And then it was the other thing.
She
does. About,
she walks in, looks around, and says, "What a dump."
Yeah, yeah, yeah. When Satan Met a Lady, it was more written as a comedy than a serious drama. And so that's John Huston said, "I will rewrite this. Give me a break. Let me direct." And you'll see John Huston again, and you'll probably, well, maybe you won't recognize his voice, but you'll see John Huston again when we get to Chinatown. But he was a big director, directed a lot of big stars, mm-hmm. and this is his first directorial debut. But I find it fascinating that, again, in the span of 10 years, Maltese Falcon was remade 3 times. Why do you think that is, Rodrigo?
Well, back then, I think there was a lot, like, I don't know, the budgets for the movies weren't that crazy. I mean, let me structure that a different way that makes sense to human beings. I think that although you wouldn't necessarily know it from reading the accounts, there was a lot less pressure on filmmakers because the budgets weren't as astronomical as they are today.
Mm-hmm.
So you could potentially remake a movie. And if that movie was a flop, we're talking about a movie that didn't show in the majority of the country.
Yeah.
So if that movie didn't work, you could just pack up the movie and do it again. And people would literally not know. They would not know that this same movie came out 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Or maybe, you know, people just, well, but people were going to the movies left and right. It wouldn't be, I mean, I can see your point, Rodrigo, but for true movie going fans in New York, Atlanta, California, the movie theater was the place to go. So they would have probably seen this and then just said, oh, okay, here's another adaptation of one of our favorite books of the time period.
Oh, yeah. I mean, and that's the thing is, this is the 40s, right?
Right, 1941.
I mean, a lot of the rules, kind of like the unwritten rules of things, weren't established yet or had been done away with because, you know, movies in the 30s were a certain way and movies in the 40s were a certain way and movies in the 50s were a certain way. And the way that we think about movies is basically movies from the 80s forward
right.
have all these rules to them. But back in these days, those rules hadn't been invented yet.
Mm-hmm.
So you could have two competing studios doing the exact same movie at the exact same time, for example, and releasing the same movie and, you know, it being okay or not being as big of a deal and being like a legitimate competition thing as opposed to something like, you know, Capote and then In Cold Blood or whatever, mm-hmm. like being released within, you know, 5 years or 2 years of each other.
So, and also part of the problem was this thing called the Hays Code, the Hays yeah. Office. Are you familiar with the Hays Office? It's not here.
No,
it's not here.
I was hoping it was. I read a little bit of it, and it.
So, what is that? What is the Hays Code?
Well, from what I read just about this movie, they kind of what they seem to be is an ethics board, or yeah, kind of looking over content of film.
So basically, this church minister, Presbyterian minister, William H. Hays. Thought it was his duty to rehabilitate Hollywood. So he went in, starts rattling, banging, you know, the gong, getting people all riled up, and then was made, under Warren G. Harding, Postmaster General. He served, and then served 25 years as president of the Motion Picture Producers and Distributors of America, where he went in and said, here's what will make a good movie, here's what won't make a good movie, and if you don't follow these codes of conduct, and there were 25 of them. You can find them online. You couldn't use any profanity, no suggestive nudity or silhouettes or anything of lecherous intent, no illegal traffic in drugs, any inference of sex perversion, couldn't show white slavery. You couldn't show relationships between people of different races. You couldn't talk about sexual hygiene or venereal diseases. You couldn't talk about anything having to do with childbirth. You couldn't show any scenes of childbirth in the Hays Code. Certainly you couldn't show children's sex organs, ridicule of the clergy, willful offense to any nation, race, or creed was not permitted in the Hays Code in the first bits. And then there were things that you could do things that you could do but might be considered in poor taste. The use of firearms could be considered in poor taste. Theft, robbery, safe cracking, dynamiting of trains could be seen as not appealing to the Hays Code. And so what would happen is, and this is what happened, and sometimes it's rarer today, but, you know, a decade ago, it was not uncommon as they're renovating a major movie theater, mm-hmm. like the Fox Pavilion in Atlanta. It's not uncommon then for people to find these missing reels of film, because what would happen is this Hays Code was used differently and interpreted differently from town to town. So if a movie actually came to our town, the movie review committee would sit down and they would view it and they would physically say, okay, we have to cut out this section of the film because it's not allowed, or this scene has to be cut out. And they just splice it together and run it. And most of the time, sometimes those sections were not added back into the film before it shipped off to the next town. Mm-hmm. So in some cases you can find entire scenes and entire reels that have been missing for decades because of these local censor boards and the Hays Code going through and snipping these things out from town to town as they migrated through. It was really, I can see how it happens, right? Mm-hmm. If we don't want the government to censor, then we have to censor ourselves. So let's get this guy to come in and censor. The Comic Code Authority is the same exact way. The Motion Picture Association today is based on that same thing. It's a regulatory thing, self-regulatory. Mm-hmm. It has no government backing whatsoever. And if you want to see a good movie about the MPAA, go watch this movie called This Movie Not Yet Rated, or it's just called Not Yet Rated.
Yeah.
Very good documentary.
Netflix.
Yeah, I would recommend that you watch that. It really goes into the censoring of motion pictures. So in the case of this movie being made multiple times, I can easily see why, because of the Hays office not allowing this films to be seen, that you have to tread very lightly. Now, in the book, Rodrigo, nothing is taboo in the book.
No, there isn't. I mean, and it has been a long time since I saw it. So, you know, in the book, it pretty explicitly says that they sleep together.
Right.
But in the movie, it's pretty ambiguous. Mm-hmm. And yeah. I think it even suggests that they didn't.
Right. Well, no, there's no scenes of them going to bed together. In fact,
the
only time you see Humphrey Bogart's or Sam Spade's bed is at the very beginning. And it's one of those, what are the Murphy beds that fold up or something and hide away?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because you see him right in the very beginning of the movie waking
up.
Yeah, no, I always wanted to have one of those too. And then the rest of the movie, it's just a sitting room area. And so you never see her laying down. The other thing is, of course, the any kind of innuendo toward homosexuality. And certainly there are two characters that come off as homosexual in the movie, done and treated very delicately. But in the book, they come out and say Joel Cairo is homosexual. I think in the book they refer to it as the fairy or the queer. Ugh. And again, language of the time,
right?
And it's totally not acceptable today.
No.
But even in the movie, they treaded lightly in talking about Wilmer's character, because Sam Spade keeps referring to him as the Gunsel, which is a term for a homosexual man that dates an old young man who dates an older man. And because Wilmer and Gutman are together all the time, Bogart is making that claim against him, too. So they're treading on a lot of very hot topics very carefully in this movie. And did it work, Rodrigo? Did it not work?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's clear that they had to clean it up here and there, but they still pushed the envelope of what they could do.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I mean, there's like firefights and
drugging. I mean, they drug Sam Spade.
Yeah.
Murder, arson, jaywalking. There's all kinds of dangerous things happening.
There are some, from a story perspective, Zach, what else can you share with us? You had some questions or some other thoughts that you wanted to share about the story as it's seen on the big screen. And I would suggest you go and read the book if you haven't.
Yeah,
It'll take you a couple of days to read.
Yeah. So, I mean, after a lot of that murder stuff, it pretty much turns into a dialogue fest of trying to find and track down this Falcon statue, which apparently was worth a lot of money. And that is interesting because I read some of people talk about this movie and they said, you essentially forget almost what the main plot of the movie is, and you just kind of start focusing on character interactions through dialogue.
Right.
Which is interesting.
Well, I mean, the book is just full of these kind of dialogue exchanges, right?
Yeah.
And you have to bring that out, and you have to make these characters mm-hmm. believable. And in one case, you have to have a rather lengthy dialogue exchange so that a story plot point can work.
Right.
Right. So the first, the drugging of Sam Spade by Gutman is really a fascinating scene, both in how they're telling the audience the story, but also setting up Humphrey Bogart getting drugged. So the first time that Sam Spade meets Gutman, Gutman gives him a drink and says, "Oh, I never trust a man that doesn't drink."
Right.
And offers him a cigar, and Bogart is drinking a little bit of it and smoking a little bit of the cigar. And so that sets it up that if Sam Spade is supposed to be trusted, he needs to partake in the drink.
Right.
The second time, when he comes back to Gutman's apartment, he sits down, Gutman pours him a drink, and we never see Sam Spade touch the drink. And then Gutman starts to tell you this story about the Maltese Falcon, this jewel-encrusted bird as an offering to the King of Spain from the Knights of Malta. And he goes on and on and on and on. And he keeps pouring Sam Spade a drink, says, "Drink, drink," you know, and he doesn't drink it. But then as he keeps telling the story and as the dialogue keeps going for a long time, mm-hmm. Sam Spade finally takes a drink. And then by the time Gutman is finished with his story, Sam Spade passes out on the floor.
Right.
Brilliant, brilliant, brilliant story. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And a great use of dialogue in this piece. The other thing that I didn't realize, and I now have to go back and watch this yet again, that entire scene, one take.
Yeah,
from the time he enters the room, into the room, mm-hmm. and Gutman's escorting him around, and they're having their dialogue exchange, and you're going in for close-ups of Gutman as he's telling the story, all one take.
I read that after I finished it, and I didn't even remember it. Like, I did, like,
yeah.
I don't... And I tried to find it again, and I just couldn't find it. I was trying to rush through a bunch of stuff.
Right.
But, yeah, that was... I mean, I want to go watch that. Just watch that scene again, that's
amazing. From a technical standpoint, yeah this is amazing.
7 minutes.
Yes.
And you're loading 10-minute film reels in there, you got to get
Yeah, that's
going.
Pretty much a reel.
Yeah, you got to do the entire reel you're shooting in for one take.
Yeah. They rehearsed it for 2 days.
Wow.
And I don't remember how many takes they had to do, but timing had to be specific. And one of the reasons why so many people don't notice that it's one take is because they get involved in the story.
Mm-hmm.
And so, ideally, as a creator, film creator, hopefully that you become... You don't want people to notice technique, right? Mm-hmm. You don't want to call attention. We've talked about this before. You don't want to call attention to special effects. You don't want to call attention to your shaky camera shot. You don't want to call attention to anything that has to do with the film because you want to draw the audience in. And even now, all these years later, when I think about that scene, I'm like, no, there's a cutaway to Humphrey Bogart. I know that there's a cutaway to Humphrey Bogart.
I swear there's one in there.
All camera
Apparently
moves.
Apparently not.
All camera moves. And that's what makes it so amazing when you go back and look at it again. It's like, oh, really? No way. And that's why I want to go back and watch that again, just to see how well it's done. The other thing that's amazing about that scene, not only just the dialogue and how you draw the audience in and get to play the trick of the mind, that was Sidney Greenstreet's really first day on the set. That was the first scene that they shot with him.
Wow.
And so for an actor to come up, and even with rehearsals for 2 days, to come in and give that performance in that scene shows the talent that Sidney Greenstreet brought to the piece.
That was his first film, too.
Yeah, his first film. Yeah. He came from a stage actor is where he came from, stage on the stage. And Hal Wallace, who is the producer on this, just basically said, hey, you should cast this guy. He's got a great laugh. He's got this great look to him. At the time, people estimate he was somewhere between 280 and, I don't want to say 350 pounds. So I'm catching up to him pretty close, pretty quickly.
Oh.
But this performance...
You can do it, Steven.
I can do it. I know I can.
Keep going.
So his performance and his character were so impactful in the movie that this, again, Sidney Greenstreet then later goes on in Casablanca, mm-hmm. Again with Peter Lorre, and we'll talk about him in just a moment again. People liked him so much that the atomic bomb that was dropped on Nagasaki was renamed Fat Man in honor of him, of Gutman. And it's kind of weird, too, that he gets the name Gutman, and he's this colossally fat guy, yeah. Right?
Well, definitely the books or the names that the characters have in the book and by extension the movie make a lot of sense. You know, Gutman is a big fat guy. Sam Spade in the book is like this skinny, like mm-hmm. kind of sharp guy, basically, is what he is. There's also the issue of, you know, like the violence thing mm-hmm. because the detective agency is Spade and Archer, or Archer and Spade. You know, one is a bow and one's a sword, basically. Oh,
yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Interesting. Anything else about the story or the characters that you want to talk about? You had a question.
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm.
At the very end of the film, when everything is kind of been settled and it's determined the Falcon statue they thought was the Maltese Falcon ends up not, and stuff. And Sam Spade says,
"People get hauled off. Yeah, people go fly off. Yeah."
He says, "Someone asked what that statue is," and he says, "This is the thing dreams are made of." I believe mm-hmm. is the line,
mm-hmm.
and I recognized it. And I said, "Ugh, I should probably know what this is from or what this means. Or I know this is somewhat significant, but I don't know why."
So, what do you think it means? Let me just ask you that. I mean, regardless of where, you've probably heard it before because people are referencing this movie,
right?
So, what do you think it means?
I'm going to venture a guess.
Okay.
That it is about what the statue means, and that it wouldn't, like, people weren't overly upset that the Falcon was not that the right Falcon, because it meant that their adventure of trying to find the Falcon would be able to continue.
Yeah, you're right, because here's the thing. Everything that they do for years, for Gutman especially, he says he's been on the search for this Falcon 17 for 17 years. Yeah. So his entire life has been refocused to finding this bird. As he reaches the end of this journey, he's willing to do anything to get it, but suddenly realizes, oh, wait, when I do get this bird, it's all over for me. Mm-hmm. What am I going to do next? Well, now that it's not the real bird, I can continue on with my quest.
Right.
But in another way of thinking, why do people play the lottery? Why do people make that bet on black? Why do people, you know, take that risk to get that? I mean, why do people play the lottery?
Hopefully big reward.
What's the reward?
Lots of money.
Okay, and a lot of people will dream of what they can do with all of this money, right? So this is the thing. This bird represents the things that dreams are made of. I had a dream that I'm going to be able to do this and do this and do this and do this. The bird represents those dreams of people. Mm-hmm. Now, Rodrigo may have some other things to add onto this, especially how it ties back into Shakespeare, correct?
Yeah. Supposedly, I mean, and people have read that this, the expression itself comes from Shakespeare. From The Tempest, and I think I have the actual quote here somewhere. Okay. We are such stuff as dreams are made on, and our little life is rounded with a sleep, from The Tempest.
Mm-hmm. That's Prospero saying that.
Yeah. So, you know, there's a few ways to read that. I think you can, as Stephen said, it's just sort of like this incentive to follow your dream or this far off ideal of what your dream is. And when you achieve it, you will have everything you ever wanted. The other thing is kind of a meta statement of what is this? Like, literally, this is nothing but a fake bird, but this is the stuff that this here story was made of. Like, this entire thing revolved around the Falcon, and the Falcon turned out to be nothing. So it's literally nothing but dreams, and everything that happened, you know, being a fictional story, is the dreams that came from the Falcon.
Mm-hmm. There's another word that we use when we talk about something that has no bearing on the story, but is what leads the story through, right? Mm-hmm. It's called a MacGuffin.
Right.
Okay. Rodrigo, MacGuffin. what's the MacGuffin?
A MacGuffin is exactly the Maltese Falcon. It's something that everybody wants, but has generally no bearing on the story. So, you know, we never, you could argue that, Jules, like the briefcase in Pulp Fiction is a MacGuffin. Mm-hmm. You could argue, you could, I mean, there's a lot of things in history and in film where the point is to get it rather than what it actually does. I mean, right. Sure, it will, Christ's cup will make you young forever, but we don't get to that until the very end of the film. It kind of doesn't matter what is in the Ark of the Covenant or what is in, you know, or what that magic baby is going to do until you get to the very end of the story.
Mm-hmm. And most of the time when you do hit that point, mm-hmm. it really isn't as important as the journey to get there.
And often will provide a cheap out.
Right.
If it does actually do something.
North by Northwest is the same way, where, and we'll look at this, Cary Grant is mistaken, or Cary Grant or Jimmy Stewart, I forget which one, because he uses them both. I'm pretty sure it's Cary Grant, is mistaken for somebody else, and he has something that these other people want. And so he's chased across the country after this thing, and he's trying to figure out what this thing is. And once you finally realize what this thing is, it was not as exciting as what put us on the edge of Mount Rushmore. Mm-hmm. Right. And we'll watch that movie later on if you haven't ever watched North by Northwest. Hitchcock uses the MacGuffin a lot.
Yeah. I believe he's the one who coined the phrase MacGuffin.
Okay.
What an example of a past movie that we've watched on Zach on Film, the buried treasure in the grave in Good, Bad, and Ugly kind of be a MacGuffin?
Yeah, to an extent. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. And as Rodrigo said, the briefcase in Pulp Fiction,
briefcase, also
a MacGuffin. So yeah, all of these things that just, that's our driving force mm-hmm. to get from here to there. Lost, the TV series, that they use MacGuffins a lot in that mm-hmm. never pay off to the end. And you'll see these things as they appear. And so if you're not familiar with that term, that's a new term that you can write down. And add it to your lexicon of terms that you can use when telling a story.
Yay.
The MacGuffin is a trope that upsets a lot of people, but it is very, very effective in giving your characters a reason to move, to act, to go from point A to point B. So kind of keep that in mind. The other thing that is important about the Maltese Falcon is a lot of film historians consider this the very first film noir movie. Okay. Mm-hmm. What does film noir mean?
Me. Of course.
Yes. Of course, Zach. This of is course. You supposed to learn.
Yes,
did you
course.
Not listen to the intro at the beginning of the show?
No. I skip that part every time I listen. film noir is, it's kind of like an era, feeling.
Yeah. All right.
You're
kind of in the right.
You're in the right ballpark. Let me help you out. What does noir mean? It's a French word that means
crime.
No.
Dang it. cool smoking guy.
Let's see. I'm so curious about Siri with what Siri can do. Hold on. Let's see if Siri can answer this question. Whoops. Siri, what does noir mean? Oh, not noir. Siri.
Well, that pretty much sums up Siri.
Noir. What does it mean? Bet it won't find it either. Noir. What does it mean?
This might answer your question.
No, it does not. It's stupid Siri. No wonder nobody likes Siri.
This might answer your question, and it's just a gif of a kitten.
Basically. So, noir, N-O-I-R, French word for... Did you look it up while I was doing that? I was giving you time to stall, vamping
for time.
The term
film noir is French for black film.
Okay, so black film. What do you think of when you think black film?
Black and white.
Okay, but what else specifically?
Dark.
Dark, okay. So, film noir are movies that are very dark, very edgy, often dealing with borderline taboo topics, dark shadows, tough women, the femme fatale, strong heroes like Sam Spade. That's typically
morally ambiguous heroes.
Right, morally ambiguous heroes. So this could be the very first noir film, movie, in that it is very dark, tells a story that you're only finding in detective stories, pulp books. Is that me?
No, I think I hit some prong.
Oh, okay. And so now you know what film noir means, right? And typically, yes, when we look at film noir, we think black and white movies because Dial M for Murder, North by Northwest, Maltese Falcon, all shot in black and white. But Chinatown... Touch of Evil, Chinatown is a color movie, and you'll look at that, and that's a noir tale as well. So just kind of keep that in mind.
But it was itself created as an ode. Oh,
yeah, sure, as an homage to
and to noir.
Yeah, and it had John Huston in it. So there you go. let's take a quick break, Zach, and let us thank some people who made this show possible.
Yes, let's thank all of the wonderful people who made this show possible. And those names this week would be Alistair Shields, Lee Goldberg, Kara Mosier, Pontus Hallen, Eric Waddell, Alex Springman, Joseph Smith, Christian Fisher, Ingrid Lind, John. Ooh, I probably messed that one up. Ethan Martinez. Thank you for your donations to Major Spoilers and keeping shows like Zach on Film going each and every week for your enjoyment.
And again, if you want to find out how you can support this show or how you can get in on the ground floor of our members-only section, you can find out more at majorspoilers.com. Help us reach our funding goat. So some technique, Zach. What are some techniques that you noticed in this film that kind of lead into this idea of what made this the definition of film noir?
One of the first kind of things I noticed was... shot angles. They did a lot of upshot angles, which was like, hey, I see a ceiling. I remember a movie that did this about this time period, Citizen Kane. I said, oh, hey, what time did Citizen Kane come out? Oh, it came out in September of 1941. Oh, the same year as this. What year did this one? Oh, a month later. I'm like, oh, that's... Because originally I said, oh, this drew from Citizen Kane. I said, well, not really, because I only came a month out of bar.
Yeah, so... Arthur Edison is the director of photography in this movie. Greg Tolan is the cinematographer in Citizen Kane. Both of them using this action. And just because it's Hollywood, it wouldn't surprise me if, as the production of both of these are going on, there isn't some communication going on between cinematographers and their guilds. But yeah, one of the interesting things we see about this, and somebody look up, one of you two look up really quick, Humphrey Bogart's height. Look up Humphrey Bogart's height. How tall was he?
They actually just updated IMDb, so that's included on actor profiles.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That IMDb. What it. Won't it?
Humphrey Bogart was 5'8".
So a short guy, Zach. He's shorter than I am, okay? By about 2 inches.
Yeah, that's very short.
Small guy. In fact, they have a Humphrey Bogart furniture collection that I've checked out before. It's... Even for someone of my height, it's uncomfortable to sit in, and I'm 5'10".
Really?
It's uncomfortable to sit in that furniture just because it's made for a smaller bodied person.
Huh.
And I think if you go back and you look at the height of the average American male in 1940, you'll find that 5'7", 5'8", was about that height. So when you create very big, imposing, tall characters, as Sam Spade has described in the book, how do you convey that on film when you've got Humphrey Bogart, who's a relatively short person? Well... If you watch The Maltese Falcon and they're using those low angles and you're seeing Bogart in the scene and he looks like the ceiling's right on top of his head, suddenly he becomes a much taller character on screen.
Right. Oh, wow. You know how tall Peter Lorre is?
Probably like 4'11".
He's 5'5".
5'5"?
That's tiny.
Yeah, he's a... Well, 5'5 isn't that short. Peter Lorre is pretty
that's,
short.
That's not that short. That's like a Great Dane at the shoulder.
So what did you think of Peter Lorre, just as a question? You've now watched Peter Lorre in two movies back-to-back, M, and now The Maltese Falcon.
I like him. I really liked him here. He didn't have to give a ginormous speech at the end. I think I really liked his character, and I especially liked how he was portrayed as he could be. He kind of started off as somewhat serious in the beginning, and that kind of just kept on fading, fading. And that first scene where he's in there and he's sticks up Sam Spade, and then Spade takes his gun from him, and then they kind of talk everything out, and they're all cool with each other, and then he says, "Can I have my pistol back?" "Oh yeah, I forgot I even had this." And he gave it back. It's like, "Now will you please stand with your hands behind your back?" And he's in the room. I laughed so hard at that point. I thought that was so funny.
But do you notice how Joel Cairo's character just totally unravels by the time you hit the end of the film? I mean, he comes in and he's introduced as this very mysterious, dark character who's got it all together, has a handkerchief that smells of gardenias. But as the movie progresses, he becomes a little bit more crazy, a little bit more threatening, a little bit more wild. And so we do see this character just kind of unravel as his world starts to become problematic when they're like, "Well, who are we going to turn in? The police need somebody for Thursby's murder." And he goes nuts. He's willing to do anything to save himself. And I think that's just a very interesting character development as we see the Lorre characters, or the Joel Cairo character, develop throughout the film. Rodrigo, do you want to add anything else about Lorre's performance?
Well, he always has a great ability to seem like he's hiding something, I guess.
Right.
Just at every moment in this movie, he is clearly looking out for himself and just does a really great job of seeming really slimy. The character certainly helps.
I love his performance in this movie.
Oh, absolutely.
Although he does a great job in him, I think this is his best performance. And that being said, people will say, "No, wait, Casablanca was much better." But I still like this. I still like this one. Going back to technique again, real quick, Zach, we're talking about what makes this noir. So first of all, you said the low camera angles, give us that upshot and make people appear more menacing. What else adds to this film noir concept? So we said black film, dark film.
Yeah. The, contrasty,
very contrasty,
the lighting,
super high contrast.
Yeah. Look at how they do the shadows. Everything in this movie is shadow. Probably a 2-to-1 contrast ratio in this, in many of the shots. 2-to-1 contrast ratio from, or lighting ratio, is where we're looking at the key light, the main source of illumination, and how intense the shadow is compared to that light. So if you have a fill light softening the shadows on one side, you might have a 2-to-1 ratio or a 3-to-1 ratio or 4 or 5-to-1. And depending on the type of film that you're shooting, that lighting ratio will change. When we're talking film noir, dark film like this, it's not uncommon to have a 2-to-1 or 3-to-1 ratio. And that is pretty dark in the shadow areas. And of course, when you're telling a detective story, those dark shadows are where the bad guys are.
Of course.
And it really works. Now, if you watch that just from the lighting standpoint alone, the one scene that is not lit with a lot of, or where a lot of shadows are not used, is in the lobby of the hotel. It's very brightly lit throughout, as in this is kind of a safe space for people to congregate, not have to worry about being harassed. I mean, that's where we see Wilmer and Sam Spade talk with one another. He calls over the house detective. The house detective knows who Sam Spade is. They give Wilmer some guff, send him on his way. Cairo comes in, does his thing after a night of whatever he's been doing, being harassed by the police or drinking or carousing or whatever he's been doing. but everybody's very safe in there. No one's pulling guns on one another. No one's threatening one another. No one's shooting one another in this very brightly lit space. But everything else, not so much.
Yeah.
Even in Sam Spade's office, which is high contrast and use of light through the windows to cast the name of the agency on the floor. Great. Yeah. So lighting is very, very important when you're dealing with film noir. Angle's very important. What about editing? Anything you notice on the editing side?
Editing seemed pretty straightforward. It was a lot of establishing and cutback one-twos conversations, which was needed in this movie, that so much conversation really did happen. It was interesting because I came from last week. You had me look up Sergei Eisenstein,
right?
And so I was watching a lot of his and reading up on a lot of his montage techniques. And
so
well,
tell
I came
us,
into it.
We said that we were going to make you do a report. Do you have your report ready?
Yeah, I can kind of talk a little bit about old Sergei Eisenstein a little bit.
Montage editing.
Yeah. So what he developed was essentially a technique for editing film, and it had different montage. There's like, I believe, five different montage styles. And, oh, let me pull them up because I'm not on my laptop.
Why'd you run out of battery?
Yeah. They were metric, rhythmic, tonal, overtonal, and intellectual. And so they're essentially just different ways to edit your movie together to create a larger impact to the story. Because Sergei came a lot from theater, and his thoughts on theater were, well, you don't necessarily need a lot of dialogue to tell a story. You tell a story also through the way people move and set design and everything else as it encompasses. But the focus on dialogue doesn't have to be the forefront. And that's what a lot he takes into his filmmaking, which helped because a lot of his movies were in the silent era.
Right.
Which kind of helped.
Right.
I know he did some essays and spoke some thoughts on once film started being used in audio started being using film, but I didn't get a chance to read through those.
So you watched some examples of some Eisenstein?
Yeah, I watched the
Potemkin.
Yeah, Potemkin at the steps of
Ogden
or whatever it was called, and how. So the first time I watched it, and I watched the clip right before I really read anything, just to see, what kind of experimental essentially stuff he was doing. I got about a 7-minute clip. I got like 3 minutes into it. I was like, why does this not seem so off the wall to me? And I said, it's because that's how films are edited now. And they take cutaways and they're stretching time out.
Right.
And it's not happening in real time, but he's taking time to show the individual aspects of the people running down these steps and from the army.
Cossacks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Cossacks.
What else? Anything else?
I know there's, in other of his styles, there are some different aspects are used, and I believe it's the intellectual montage style that will use juxtaposition of pictures of what's happening on screen, and it'll use cutaways to a different one. I don't remember which film
that's,
it was, but
that's not Eisenstein.
That was
that
Eisenstein.
That was Kulchov, I believe, who did the experiment where you saw the casket,
right?
And then you shot the woman who looked like she was crying.
Mm-hmm.
Or I'm sorry, there's shot of the casket, shot to a man with the same expression on his face, shot to a bowl of soup, cut back to the man with the same expression on his face, cut to a little girl. Cut to the man, exact same expression of his face, and because of the way it's edited together and because people's perceptions of tying these themes and ideas together, the audience interprets the emotion differently. So when they see the shot of the coffin and then the shot of the man, The audiences are like, oh my gosh, you can see the grief in his eyes.
Right.
Then they cut to the shot of the bowl of soup and then back to the man. They're like, oh, you can tell how hungry he is. And then you cut to the little girl and then you cut back to the man. He's like, oh, look at all the passion and compassion right. that he has for this child. Thing was, it is the exact same shot of the man used mm-hmm. again and again and again. I'm pretty sure that's Cole Shaw.
That's Cole Shaw. That. What I'm thinking of, if you pull up, there's a clip on YouTube where from his Sergei's movie Strike, where it's about, again, people running away from dying, and they're showing the army chase down this people and shooting them, and they're cutting that in with a slaughterhouse of cattle and then cutting them open and demonstrating the slaughter, and I believe it's also demonstrating
is that the diegetic? Is that one of the items in your montage theory?
I think this one is the intellectual.
Oh, okay.
And so that one is a little different than normal. And then rhythmic and metric have a lot to do with the beat of the movie. Mm-hmm. And he said, like, a movie should be almost cut in a manner that it flows like the pattern of a song, the beat measures of a song.
Right. And did they talk about the Russian song, what is it? Dun, 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 dun. I think that's the song that he used to kind of demonstrate how you can edit to that.
Mm-hmm.
Interestingly, that's also kind of the same song that silent movie camera operators would use, because they could keep, if they kept that beat in their head as they're cranking the film, they could 24. Keep it at a constant frame rate throughout. So, interesting. Did Zach hit on everything with the montage theory? Rodrigo, is he missing out on something?
I honestly, once you mention Battleship Potemkin, any film buff will be sated and will retreat into his cave. So I'm good.
All right, good.
I think if when I started reading into it, a director that I initially thought of, and I haven't gotten to watch this movie, I haven't had time yet, but The Tree of Life by
Aronofsky.
No,
that's, I'm thinking of the other one.
Gosh dang it. Terrence Malick.
Okay.
Where I really started thinking about how Eisenstein talks about the editing of sequences in time to make sequences greater, in that you have to worry about the editing of entire film and sequences to make middle sequences and past sequences and future sequences better as a whole. I think is really displayed in Tree of Life in the manner that that's kind of thrown together.
Okay.
With the story and all the weird elements kind of thrown in there, especially then also with Eisenstein's not need of dialogue in the forefront kind of comes through in Tree of Life also.
All right. Good. So what then from, and hopefully we've talked a lot about things that pop up here in The Maltese Falcon.
Mm-hmm.
What are you going to apply to your future endeavors?
Well, I think we can look at MacGuffin mm-hmm. From a writing aspect, and for character motivations for a story, and just wrapping a plot around that, and then looking at lighting styles to cast a certain mood and let that kind of direct the feeling of a story, or some takeaways from Maltese Falcon.
Okay. Anything else?
Placement of people on the scene,
mm-hmm.
because especially in the last bit inside the apartment, it's evident of how meticulous he goes through in placing everyone. And they said that he storyboarded out this entire movie meticulously,
right,
and had it completely down pat, and then so that when they shot it, they actually shot this movie in sequence, that it was, he just nailed everything, and it was, everyone was ready to go.
So storyboards as I harp good. On, how many times do I harp on storyboards?
All the time. Storyboards are important, especially when you get to my age and you think they're stupid. That when the first time he talks about them, then you get to this point, you're like, no, storyboards are like the best thing in the world.
Use them, Zach.
Yeah.
Use your storyboards. Did you use your storyboards in your final project?
Yeah.
Did you?
Yeah.
For your commercial? Did you have to pitch them to your client?
No.
Okay. You know what? Maybe we should make that. Can we put those up on online for people to look at?
My projects?
Uh-huh. Can we put the stuff you're doing for your final project? Your
they're actually project? I can tweet out some links and stuff. Okay. Or you want to put them on the site. Or...
So if you want to see these links, you can follow Zach at ZWolf, and I'll retweet.
Yeah, okay.
But you can follow ZWolf, and he'll at some point post a link to these commercials that he's just done for his final project. So he can graduate. Not graduate from this podcast, of course, but graduate from college, hopefully.
He will never graduate from this podcast.
Here forever. My student loans are increasing every episode.
All right, Rodrigo, did Zach get everything he's supposed to get out of the Maltese Falcon?
I think so. And I think if he goes back and watches it a couple more times, and actually, and he watches other noir films... then he will definitely start to see how this movie basically exploded that genre. And then maybe we can go back to German expressionism and talk about that.
Okay. All right. It's going to be a while before we get back to German expressionism.
Sure.
Zach, I think that you did pass this week.
Thank you.
Good job. You're starting to see things with a more critical eye. By the time this is done, by the time we hit every movie on this list, Rodrigo, Zach's going to know more than we do.
Oh, absolutely.
And I think you can finish, Rodrigo.
I was going to say, I kind of wish that I'd had like three people like yelling at me about movies back when I was in school.
Oh, so
like,
do I.
I would have learned a lot more.
When I was watching Iron Man 3 last weekend, I realized I was kind of becoming a... I almost... lightly used the term film snob. I was God, I wish they'd stop using special effects. And I don't know. I'd rather just be watching like a black and white movie right now or something. I should go watch M. That's what I kind of thought of in the middle of Iron Man 3.
You know what? And we did give kind of a spoiler review of Iron Man 3 on issue 518 of the Major Spoilers podcast, if you want to go and take a listen to this. Not to be spoilery or anything, but I thought the best visual elements of the film were the actual end credits, where it was that awesome music, awesome editing and graphics all thrown together to make that really what the movie should have been. If they could have done, and of course people would argue, well, Ang Lee did that with the Hulk, and how he transitioned from scenes and stuff. But that movie had a lot more, had a faster editing pace and had a lot more rhythm in those closing credits than the movie as a whole did.
Those are cool credits. And it didn't go for like the giant 3D stuff that you kind of see in Avengers and Captain America and stuff.
Yeah,
it was good credits.
I like that credit sequence. So good. All right, Zach, pass this week.
Great.
Next week, you're going to jump ahead a few years, about 20 years. We're taking a look at the Maltese. The Maltese Falcon. We're taking a look at the Maltese Falcon again. No, we're taking a look at the Manchurian Candidate from 1962.
Manchurian Falcon.
1962. That one stars Murder, She Wrote, and I believe it also stars... What? It does.
Murder, She Wrote and Rat Pack.
Rat Pack and Murder, She Wrote. All star in The Manchurian Candidate. No, this one stars Frank Sinatra, Lawrence Harvey, Janet Leigh, Angela Lansbury, Henry Silva, James Gregory. It is a political thriller, Zach. And it's got some scary undertones as well.
Great.
So enjoy that, and we will talk about that next time on Zach on Film.
Yep, so that's going to wrap it up here. Thanks for listening for another episode of Zach on Film. If you would like to own your very own copy of The Maltese Falcon, might I recommend heading over to majorspoilers.com, where you can comment in the podcast section and give us your thoughts on Maltese Falcon, and then click on the Amazon link on the front page, where you can go to Amazon and shop to your heart's content. And buy all your movie needs, including The Manchurian Candidate, or Maltese Falcon, or any other movies we've watched on Zach on Film and talked about. And a little bit of that will come back our ways, but no extra costs will be applied to you. So we would thank you if you shop through Amazon that way. That'll wrap it up here. And make sure to come back next week as we talk Manchurian Candidate. I can't talk. And talk more films on Zach on Film.
One of the things I forgot to mention this week is I really wanted to talk about the Falcon itself, and that it's modeled on a real bird. The Nippenhausen hawk, which was made in 1697 for George Wilhelm von Knipenhauser, for the Holy Roman. He was the Count of the Holy Roman Empire and now resides with the Duke and Duchess of Devonshire. But it's supposedly encrusted with red garnets, amethysts, emeralds, sapphires all over this bird. There were only three models of the Maltese Falcon made for the movie. The first one was destroyed because Humphrey Bogart dropped it.
No.
I know. So there were actually three. Two of them were 47 pounds. So, you know, when you're looking at them carry the bird through the scene, they're actually carrying 47 pounds in a couple of those. Those were the lead ones. One of them was destroyed at the end of the movie because you saw Greenstreet slashing at it with his knife to show that it was lead. So one of them was destroyed. I think that one is at the Smithsonian now. The other one is in a private collection and sold for something like $400,000 several years ago.
It's not as much as they were hoping to in the movie.
Well, which, I think,
you know, well, which is weird, you know, and kind of weirdly symbolic, because it's like in the movie, the Falcon turns out to be fake.
Right.
So this fake Falcon is worth so much because it starred as a fake in a movie.
Total together of the three of the birds that are remaining, the lead and resin Falcons are valued in excess of $2 million.
So all three of them, or two of them,
the two of them. There is a great TED Talk that you need to go watch.
I like TED Talk.
The TED Talk with Adam Savage, the Mythbusters guy.
Oh,
because you can't find the bird, and though there have been replicas made of this, you can go online. You can find little plastic replicas. Savage wanted to build an actual sized model of the Maltese Falcon, and he tells an incredible TED Talk story of how he tried to take measurements and sizes and comparing Humphrey Bogart to the size of the bird and how he cast it and how he built it. And it's just fantastic, especially, and I won't spoiler the end of his TED Talk, but he goes through a lot of work and then has to do it again.
Oh.
And he says why. And when he tells you why, you're like, oh, duh. But it's a great TED Talk, and I would encourage you to go look that up.
Okay.
Just go look up Adam Savage, TED Talk. And I think he's only done one, so you should be able to find it pretty easily. So, but I did want to mention that about the Falcon, because even the fake bird is worth more than the real bird is.